Well, I think we should begin. First of all, to give you a more secure feeling, with these lights, I can't see any of you. Except that I have noticed appropriately my wife's presence. And for those of you that may not know, this is Steve Old. Would you stand up? It's been like that for 25 years. Well, what we planned for today, you're all familiar with what this affair has in terms of the title, this gathering of people. And it occurred to me when I was first approached by the Academic Festival Committee. I have to be honest, what occurred to me first when I was approached by the committee was, no, I don't want to do that. And this young lady over here, I mean, will you identify yourself by standing up and being suitably embarrassed? She pressured me. And so we agreed that it would be a good idea. And then we talked some more about it and how to handle it. And it was decided that we'd try to identify some people that have had an interaction with my presidency here. And I think in all cases, an interaction with the university before my presidency, but certainly since August of 79 when I came. And so we talked about a format, and this is what we decided would be an appropriate format. I would do what I'm doing now in terms of some sort of an introduction to this audience. And then we would give each of the people on this panel, whom I will introduce in a few minutes, and I think most of you probably know them. We'll give them 5, 6, 7 minutes, whatever it takes to make some sort of a statement. We did not go over these statements. Some of them may be painful for me. Hopefully not. And then I'll kind of react to some of those observations made by this panel. And the point we want to get to as quickly as possible in the time that we have is for there to be some interaction with the audience. And so what I want to encourage you please to do when we, and I'll signal you when we're at this point, when we sort of run out of gas up here in terms of our presentations, we'll want questions. And because my wife pulled that trick on me and was defiant momentarily, I'm now going to include her in the people who will respond to questions. So come up with some tough ones for her. Let me first introduce the panel here, and I'll just go around the table. I'm not going to go through their entire histories, and I would appreciate it if they try to give some sense of that when they make their remarks. But I'll give you a sense of it, those of you that may not know, what their link is with this university of ours, and also with my presidency. Janet Dean, beginning here on my right, your left, was in the president's office as an employee before I came here. There were essentially two people in there, Marge Kuhn and Janet Dean. And you all know that over the last 17 years, Janet's worked very hard and now serves in the labor relations office on our campus here, and she can elaborate a bit about that and allude to that and how she got there and whatever else she's going to do. But Janet's been a close professional and personal friend since actually before I began the presidency, because the process and the way it used to work before we were a system was a little bit different. There was a lot of interaction with the staff and, in the president's office before I even came here. Many of you know I was at that time the president of the University of Alaska system, so I just couldn't drop down here on weekends to look into some things before I finally came here in August of 79. I had to do it all by phone and by writing, so that was my introduction to Janet, even before I had seen her. To my immediate right, Roy Strasbach, I made note of the fact that he's not wearing his Mercyhurst tie today. Roy was a professor of, I'll explain that later. Roy was a professor of history when I came here in 1979, and then through a variety of moves involving promotion for Roy and into the administration and a variety of positions on the campus here, deanships and so forth. Roy eventually retired, I guess, three years ago. And as a reward for all of the years of benefits and pay and so forth, and a pension provided him by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, he went immediately to work for Mercyhurst College. And so I tease him about that. In fact, he came to visit me a few months ago, and he was wearing his Mercyhurst tie. That's why I made that tie anymore. This just seems to be a regular generic tie.
Right.
So Roy will then be a part of looking into this past 17 years. On my immediate left, probably known to most of you here. If you don't know him from Edinburgh University, you've seen him with his fiddle down in Erie with the Erie Philharmonic. I think you've been with the Philharmonic for 25 years? 28 years. He's also now a frequent traveler between this part of the world and his home in the Outer Banks in North Carolina, still has his home in Edinburgh. My executive assistant for 10 years. And before that, another administrative position in the continuing ed in a couple of other areas. And before that, a professor of music on the campus here. And despite his youthful appearance, he actually has something in the neighborhood of about 75 years of experience working for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Cliff Cox. Bob Carruthers, first of all, I want to be very serious and personally and publicly thank Bob for getting his schedule adjusted in such a way that he could be with us today. Bob currently serves as the president of the University of Rhode Island, and if you notice the glisten of a tear in his eye, it's not necessarily his nostalgic feelings about this university. It's because UMass beat them by 3 points last night. So that's the first problem with his schedule. He had to watch the University of Rhode Island UMass game last night. But the truth is, Bob is a very busy person and was able to fly out late last night from Rhode Island, where, as I said, he serves as the president of that institution. Bob has served as a chancellor of another system in this nation and the president of another campus in this nation. And I'm going to tell one quick anecdote at this point about Bob and probably remove three paragraphs from his 5-minute presentation. But I also know Bob to be one of the world's leading experts on winging it, so he'll do all right. Back in 1979 when I came, there were a lot of problems facing the university, and somewhere around 1980, late 1980, Bob, who when I came here was a member of the faculty in the English department, he was the chair of the department, I went to him, and it was not an easy thing to do. I persuaded him to become the dean, which he accepted. Bob's problem was a problem that we should all have. He's so good that I saw after a very short time of watching him as a dean that he would make an excellent vice president. One of the problems I faced in 79, 80, 81 was no money to hire anyone. So anybody we had to try to get the job done here at Edinburgh University pretty much had to come from Berlin, had to be subjected to on-the-job training. So I went to Bob and I asked him if he would like to be a vice president. Wasn't actually leaping at that opportunity, but then when he began to look a little more interested, I broke it to him that it was a double vice presidency. Now, even my own current administrative staff knows that I love to deal in more than one job assignment. I love to squeeze those rocks and get everything. So I offered Bob the opportunity of a lifetime, which was to not only be the vice president for finance of an institution facing serious financial problem, but I also threw in being vice president for student affairs at the same time. And he basically said yes, but then I really shot my mouth open. I said, Bob, you will do so well that my guess would be that by 1983, and I even went so far as to say July, you'll be gone from here and you'll be the president of your own university. And that's actually what happened. Unfortunately for us, in many ways, he left in 1983, became president of the university, and then went on to his current job now as president of the University of Rhode Island. So it's an interesting relationship that I have with Bob. I also had the good fortune today to have him stop by. We had lunch together and talked about several thousand things that go back over the last 17 years. So that's essentially the panel. I didn't do justice to some very rich and deep biographical information, but they can sort of fill it in. And besides, as I look around here, there are a lot of people here that, know these four people. So without any further time being taken by me, let me begin, and I'll start on my right and work this way. We'll do the presentations. One thing I want you to know, there have been no discussions between any of us here about what's coming, so I really don't know what's coming. But you're the first one to let us know what's coming. Janet Diebold.
Thank you very much, President Diebold. As President Diebold mentioned in his brief remarks about each of the panel members, he alluded to the fact that the other panel members were all previous faculty members. So as you can see, they don't have prepared remarks because they're used to getting out and speaking before a crowd. I have prepared remarks. And I hope you'll bear with me as I make note of that. August of 1979 was a crisis time for Edinburgh State College. A deficit of $1.42 million faced President Diebold as he took office. His first charge by the Commissioner of Higher Education at the time was to present a balanced budget by the end of the 1980-81 fiscal year. The budgetary crisis was real. Our labor intensity was approximately 87% of the total budget. There were over 40 leaking roofs on campus. No deferred maintenance had been done for years. And there was even a severe shortage of snow shovels on the campus, for which we all know removal of a minimal amount of snow during our typical short winter season here at Edinburgh. They just were nowhere to be found. There was no honeymoon period, and President Diebold did not have the luxury of sitting back and easing himself into this new position. He reacted to the president, to the commissioner's challenge with a logical, decisive action plan to overcome the financial crisis which threatened the very existence of the college. I worked in the president's office at this time and could give you many examples, but I've only chosen a few. The office was not equipped with state-of-the-art technology as we have today. Therefore, President Diebold dictated his correspondence directly to me. My shorthand skills were a little rusty, to say the least, but they rapidly improved. As we all know, President Diebold is not often at a loss for words and likes to keep the paper flowing. So we quickly became well acquainted, since I was literally spending many hours in his office each and every day. This is how I really got to know President Diebold and his family. He always liked to share stories of his young daughter, Jessica, and I, in turn, would share stories of my two children. The night Stacy was born, he even left a note on my telephone that I could see when I first came in the next morning. Though the hours of dictation stretched on and on and on, his sense of humor was always in evidence. And I believe he received that trait from his mother, for those of you who know her. One of my favorite stories is about the president's residence. And I know this will be hard for some of you to believe if you've been in the president's residence recently. But it was quite sparse when President and Mrs. Diebold came to the campus. The dining room had a sideboard and a lovely, lonely light bulb hanging from where the chandelier should be. Beds had to be brought in from the residence hall storage so they would have a place to sleep. There just wasn't very much preparation for the arrival of President, Mrs. Diebold, Jessica, and their dog, Hannah. Because of the budgetary crisis, we had to manufacture our own training and leadership development. President Diebold was always willing to serve as a mentor and provide examples of how we could accomplish the tasks before us and still remain within the constraints of the budget. He even implemented a faculty intern position within the president's office. His open door policy for students, faculty, and staff helped us to emerge from our difficulties as a stronger, more viable institution of higher learning. Policies and procedures which guide this institution today were originally implemented under his guidance. I am certain that most of these policies and procedures will continue to guide Edinburgh long after his departure. You should also know that due to his direct leadership and presidential directive, minority employees on staff greatly increased in 1988. I can recall President and Mrs. Diebel visiting the residence halls and meeting with the students during evening hours and dining with them in the cafeteria. As a matter of fact, when they met in the residence halls, they would always find at least two chairs for President and Mrs. Diebel to sit on, that the students would have to sit on the floor because there wasn't any other furniture in the lobby. I had the opportunity to leave the president's office to take a promotion during President Diebel's fifth year. It was a difficult decision for me to make because I was comfortable in that position for 13 years, and I enjoyed working with President Diebel on a daily basis. But he encouraged me and counseled me and helped me to arrive at my decision, which I look back on being the best I could have made. Without his inspiration and his faith in my abilities, I may have lacked the courage to strike out into a new field. I still have fond memories of working on the first ever capital campaign in Edinburgh's history and helping to raise $6.7 million. Through these efforts, Reader Hall and the Performing Arts Center are today a viable part of Edinburgh's campus landscape, and we have President Diebel to thank for this. While going through some old files, I came across a letter written to faculty and staff of Edinburgh in October of 1979, which I believe epitomizes President Diebel's leadership style and abilities. I would like to quote one paragraph from that letter. No, quote, no one on our campus or within our community at large is more concerned than I that the personal and family sufferings caused by our budgetary crisis be minimized. As president of the college, however, I must also be concerned that Edinburgh remain a viable institution committed to providing low-cost, high-quality programs and services to its many constituencies. To do this, we must operate within our own budgetary limits, and we must provide equitable distribution of funds to our various budget categories. I am certain this is the proper approach to take. Our credibility as an institution of higher learning depends, in my judgment, on this approach. Much work and cooperation is required from each of us if we are to achieve these purposes. When I became your president, I believed this achievement was possible. I still do. Each day, I realize that all of you take pride in your accomplishments and in Edinburgh State College. Each day, I realize that you share my hope for a secure future. I ask for your continued commitment and dedication, end quote. Thank you, President Diebel, for leading us with a secure future.
Roy Strausbach came to Edinburgh State College in the fall of 1966. He was actually hired by Tom Miller shortly before his death the year before. Before President Diebel came to Edinburgh University, I served in the history department as a professor of history, chairperson and assistant chair when he arrived. That's my background when he came on campus. Subsequent to that, in 1983, I found myself as Associate Vice President of Administration, Student Personnel Services, and everything else he wanted me to do, which was enough. Within a year and a half, I was Dean of Continuing Education, and within 2 years after that, Dean of Academic Administration. Along with that, one of the things I've thoroughly enjoyed doing in 17, 18 years has been to serve as president of the Auxiliary Corporation in addition. And I might remind President Carruthers that when he was a fraternity brother at Edinburgh, he did attempt to get the college to give him permission to buy land for a fraternity house on Darrow Road. He could tell you more about that era. I found that one in a file, Bob. Some of the things that are important to me and the contributions that have been made by President Diebel and the institution over the past 17 years focus, first of all, on resources. If anything, we were in great need of resources, but I'm speaking specifically to some of the creative engineering that happened, specifically when Reeder Hall was slated to be torn down, the building in which we now sit, and allegedly there were cult activities right about where we sit.
Devil worship.
Devil worship or something in this abandoned and boarded up building. While we did get a grant from the Commonwealth to do work through some creative engineering and raising money in the community, we not only were able to accomplish saving Reeder and restoring it, but also what is now known as the Center for Performing Arts, or the old Student Union, if you go back that far. That's but one example, I think, of President Diebold's leadership very early on and attempting to get badly needed resources. If it was not a gas well that we explored and never did come to fruition, or whether it was working with the then Pennsylvania Department of Education to get special capital appropriations, that was focused work to bring the resources to Edinburgh State College. With the development, and perhaps something that rings true to me, I became an administrator within his administration on the day we became a university and the state system of higher education came into being. That was a dream that went back through two previous presidents and came to fruition in 1983. It was so important for us as an institution because of the manner in which we were funded. And I can tell you, President Diebold sent me into battle at the state level working on the first allocation formula. It was exciting, but the kinds of contributions that were made allowed us, if you will, to get our fair share as the years went along. But not only in working with the Commonwealth was there attention to getting the resources we needed to facilitate education. Within the community and what we call today development work began very early. We can cite small contributions from this immediate community. We can also take a look at President Diebold moving into the Erie community very quietly, very early on, positioning us so that we could go to the community, what's it called, Boston?
Erie Conference.
The Erie Conference on Community Development, and have, as a public institution, their sanction to engage in a capital campaign. One of the first within the state system of higher education, and an exceptionally successful one as well. Not only that, in the early days, I can remember joking with him about a year ago at a football game, he looked down and said, oh, they have new band uniforms. The first year he was here, we had to struggle, can we afford band uniforms? The president of the college had to worry about such things. Now they occur at some other place, and without that kind of worry we had in those days. Within university services, or as it was then called, student services, we had an opportunity, because of the low enrollment, to acquire Darrell Place Apartments. The owners were in default. We acquired those, turned them around, and that became seed money for both the for the Taylor House and our ability to bring that online as a building that could serve the institution and provide very needed space for offices, but also good space where we could turn our open hand to the community. In Erie, those kinds of things did a lot to turn around Edinburgh's image. And if you've been here for any length of time whatsoever, the perception, right or wrong, we're not talking about that, of what we were had to be changed. And by reaching out and being responsible members of the Erie community, that helped, and that helped with student development. When Janet mentioned leaking roofs, I became Dean of Continuing Education, and Dr. Williams will certainly remember Early Hall, and virtually every office throughout Early Hall had a bucket. I think I won with 3 buckets in my office, and
that's why I moved it.
That's right. In addition to this, the other area that I'd like to talk about, and what I remember well, is President Diebold's commitment to academics and learning by doing the kinds of things that also help to change perceptions and to utilize the real resource of the university, its faculty. The honors program, going through Don Swift as a leader, then Joe Comey as a leader, and then Ted Atkinson as a leader. Not only with a growing honors program and a commitment right in Reader Hall to honors programming, there was the outreach overseas, be it to Pakistan, to China, to programs in England. It was an important initiative that allowed students to grow, students from other countries to grow, and for our faculty to have that opportunity to experience something a bit more cosmopolitan. So in 17 years, has the university changed? It's changed a tremendous amount from one that was struggling and very close to the edge to we can now celebrate at an academic festival a flourishing institution. It took the resources to get the job done. It took dealing with our mission as a public institution reflecting the policies of the Commonwealth. That meant working within the SHE system after it was created. And then finally, I think we've done much, and I think President Diebold has provided the leadership for a growth in academic affairs that has benefited our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Roy. What? Dare I? It's been an interesting journey. 27 years ago when I came, it was a different place, and everything that Roy and Janet talked about, I think is true. I had the good fortune, or maybe it wasn't so good, of being a trustee, the faculty representative to the trustees during the last years of the previous administration. So I got some internal glimpses into the real problems that were left behind at the time when President Diebold came. And I was on sabbatical. I was very fortunate, I felt, in 1979, because I wasn't here in the fall. And I would come in the evening to get my mail to make sure that, you know, I just didn't want to hear all the noise. It was really a good thing because I had the opportunity to stand back away from the emotional climate that was on the campus with the arrival of the new president and evaluate what I thought he was doing. And I, frankly, came to the conclusion that he was doing the only thing he could do, and he was doing the best thing he could do for us. So it took us a year before we finally actually got a chance to meet. We met in the hall right after I'd been appointed the cultural affairs director. And he assured me I was really going to enjoy this job. And a year later, he assured me I was really going to enjoy being a continuing ed, and I did. And about 9 months after that, he assured me I'd really love being associate vice president for development and planning, and I did. But that was the thing that I think most often about the years of President Diebold is the opportunity that he gave to people like us out of the classroom to grow, and he kind of just dared you to do things. And thinking about the things that I would like for the president to be remembered about, they all come down to those assignments that you get, and there were some crazy ones. I remember an assignment I had to look into the purchase of Alliance College. Alliance College was, as you know, going down the tube fast, and there were secret meetings held between the Polish National Alliance and President Diebold,
And I turned out to be the point man on evaluating the possibilities of purchasing that, acquiring that, and opening a branch campus. There's a lot of interest downstate for a variety of political reasons to do that. And finally, I had an assignment to go to Harrisburg and discuss all this with the chancellor staff. And the recommendation was, you know, we really don't want to become involved in that because they had a lot of debt that was accumulated and we had to absorb. The physical plant was falling down around them. And eventually it found a good use of its own. But almost at the same time we were making that decision, I got another assignment. One afternoon in June, I got called into the president's office, and that's not always a good thing. And he said, I just came back from Erie with a luncheon with Roy Strauss-Baugh and Louis Perrico. And he said, I don't know if you know Mr. Perrico, but he has an estate that he would like to give to the university to become a branch. And that was in June, middle of June, and Mr. Perrico made a great claim to the president that this all had to take place by December 31st because the tax laws were changing. There was no question as to the benefit he might accrue by giving it now as opposed to giving it later. And that was a very interesting 6 months in all of our lives. Roy was a big help on that project, and he gave us a lot of things to do, and I spent a lot of time crawling the halls of Harrisburg. No one would believe today that you could make a gift like that come through that bureaucracy downstate. And it was even worse then because the chancellor's office really hadn't taken a good grasp of streamlining procedures yet. We still would have had to deal with a lot of the old hierarchy of PDE and make that into a reality. And on December 15th, that property changed hands. We had a nice little luncheon and said, thank you very much. And today, the rest of it's a success. Another interesting part of that story is that the president told Roy and I we had to present him with a scheme of a plan that was going to make that place go, including enrollment projections, because he had a political problem downstate, to make sure that all the Board of Governors and other people understood that this was a good thing. Well, we sat down one afternoon and brainstormed, and Roy went back to his computer, and we brainstormed several other days and came up with some enrollment projections. And the first year out, we were not near the number, we were on the number we said we'd be. And the year after that, we exceeded the second year projection and had already reached the third year projection. But those are times that I remember as being a lot of fun. It's a lot of work, but a lot of fun, and you always knew you'd have some support. Things, you know, those deals go up and down. They have their ups and downs almost always. And it would start to go down, and I'd slip down the hall and say, oh, I don't think this is going to happen. He'd say, no, wait a minute. We have to logic this through. And pretty soon, we'd have a plan to put it back in place. And eventually, of course, it did take place. And I think that if time goes on, I hope there's some way of remembering, and I'm sure in your book, and Roy's maybe too bashful to mention it, just completed the history of these years from 1976.
No. 66.
60, well, I'm close.
With President McNerney coming on and on through.
Yeah, it's about where Russ Vance's book, Previous History, left off. And so he spent a lot of his time, and I guess that's going to be a reality to be published in the
summer.
So those of you who know Roy well and want to get an edition and get it autographed and signed. But I'm sure that in there you memorialize the notion that the Perrico Center really came about because of the president's magnetism. Mr. Perrico and the president are kindred spirits in many, many ways. And he understood Mr. Perrico in ways that I don't think anybody else could. And it's because of their chemistry that we were able to bring that through. The other thing that I think I would like to remember was another challenge that was issued almost on a daily basis, and that was with regard to international education. I confess to maybe having some doubts about what we were doing all over the world, but we certainly needed a lot of things here on the campus. But he beat me to the punch. He took me with him on a trip, first to Pakistan and then on to China. And he had come back from these trips with stories about how things worked over there and about how his advice was sought and respected. And I couldn't believe that until I saw that firsthand. And it never came to me stronger than one night in the city of Zibou in China. And I have some friends here from Zibou sitting throughout the audience, and they'll remember maybe this story. It was in 1989, we were there for the Lantern Festival. Standing on the balcony of the Zibou Hotel, and the parade is going through town. And it's a gorgeous parade, and it's full of lights and celebration and bands, and it's just a gala thing, and probably a couple million people were lining the streets of Zibou that night. And the loudspeakers were hung in the trees, and every once in a while through the din you would hear a familiar English word that went like this, Diebold. And people would cheer and yell, they'd turn around and they'd point. Well, they were announcing that he was in town for the parade. And they'd point in the balcony. I felt like Mussolini. Some guy down below said, well, you know, that's Diebold, but who's the guy in the white robe with the cross? But those are the accomplishments that I think are enduring. There are so many things that happened in these 17 years together. I've been just proud to be a part of them, and it's also nice to work with a friend. You know, being a friend to your boss, I don't guess I've ever had a boss I didn't consider to be a friend, but I think it's a distinct advantage. It made communication lines a lot easier. You can really talk to each other because you have a friendship and you have a bond, and you do a lot of things together. But those are the opportunities that were given to me that I remember, and those are the things that I think you should be remembered for.
Now, President.
Well, I want to thank everyone very much for the invitation and the chance to be here today. Actually, I got a letter about a month ago asking me to do a major historical retrospective of Edinburgh University. And then about a month after that, or a couple weeks after that, I got a letter thanking me for being willing to come here and give remarks. And then at lunch today, Foster was very clear about the fact that these were to be brief remarks. So I knew that my reputation as a public speaker had preceded me. Actually, those of you who want to know what it is that presidents do, I always say they give brief remarks. They give the welcome and say a few words. I always thought that I had some skill at that portion of my job, until in an incident which is now deep in institutional mythology, someone took me to the men's room on the second floor of our building where above the electric hand dryer there, someone had posted a sign that said, "Press to hear President speak." I learned all those skills from Foster. But I am really delighted to have a chance to be here, not only to see Foster and Betty Diebold, but also to see Janet and Roy and Cliff and so many other people in this audience who were a part of that very, very challenging days in the first part of Foster's administration. I noticed that all of us in our discussion here tend to focus on those first few years because they really were the crucible in which this administration was formed and where the hard and challenging things had to be done to have all the benefits that have flowed to Edinburgh in the years since then. By the time I got that budget portfolio in 1980, that deficit had grown to about $2 million. As we were saying in lunch, the outgoing vice president brought in a thick folder of printouts and dumped it on my lap and said, "Here's your budget," and left. And when we opened that printout, we discovered only expenditures and remaining balance. There was no budget. They simply spent the money until it was gone and then instituted a freeze. And that was how money was being managed in that time. And there was no discipline at all to the process, and there was a culture of rumor and innuendo. I still tell stories about the smokestack fund, because when I got in there, I discovered there was at least $1 million every year tucked away to tear the smokestack down by the previous administration, and of course, they never tore the smokestack down. They ran the money into whatever they wanted to do. So we had this constant adventure of trying to find a rational way of managing the finances here at a time in which things were very, very difficult, and Daryl Lake and some other folks came in to help us pull that off, always under Foster's continual admonition to do the right thing. I really thought that I should take the time today to talk a little bit about Foster Diebold as a teacher, because it's been my experience with him as a teacher that has been the most powerful for me, because in that difficult situation, what he did was to bring together a team of young, untested, and untried people to be his foot soldiers in accomplishing the very difficult tasks that lie ahead of us. And all through those years, he constantly taught us. It was as much time as anything spent around that conference table in his office as we worked through these difficult issues, not just the practical side of them, but the values. What is it that we believed in here? What is it that we stood for at this institution? And as you all know, Foster's never been shy about saying what his values are. And he went on in meetings that sometimes would go 4 and 5 hours, of which 3 of them would be Foster delivering a lecture on values and management practices.
But they were Castro.
But they were immensely valuable lectures. And as Janet said, he wrote and he wrote and he wrote memos that I still have in my files, 10 and 12 pages long, telling me what I should do and what I should not do and where I made a mistake and where I should go. And every one of those memos I have and I value, and there's hardly a month that goes by I don't ask myself, what would Foster do in this situation? Because he was so clear about what the values in our organization were going to be. And if I think about all of the people who have come through this institution since I've been here, and many that I still know and talk to, that's what people remember. Not that life was always pleasant while we were learning those lessons, but that we were always being taught and we were always learning. And I thought about coming up on the plane today, what did I learn that has been of good stead to me in the years since I left this institution, which is my alma mater, in which I have a great deal of pride. And I made this little list. I learned to have a vision for what can be created, no matter how difficult and how unlikely the circumstances, to have a vision to which you can adhere and which you can live for. And to believe in that vision, because if Foster had a vision for this institution, what was most powerful about that vision was that he believed it. He believed it when some of the rest of us were asking ourselves, is he for real? And that didn't happen. But he believed it, and he believed it, and he believed in it persistently and consistently, and he articulated that vision to whoever would listen to him, wherever they were, wherever 2 or 3 were gathered together. He would tell that story about what this institution could be, and certainly there were many naysayers to that, and people who didn't believe that this could be accomplished. But he also taught me to be relentless about pursuing that vision and carrying that vision to some kind of fruition. And what I've done since I have known him and known this work is to follow that model, to pick a team of bright young people who are hungry and who had a vision of what the institution could be, to take on the mentoring role. And this is my 4th year with American Council of Education Fellows with me for the year, with mentors of all different kinds, but it was because Foster taught me that was an important thing to do, that building a cadre of people who believed in the vision and had the energy and skill to make it real was the most important thing that any leader can really do. And that has been his legacy for me. A lot of long memos with a lot of good lessons in them. A lot of long nights sitting in the old administration building, watching the crowd go by, sometimes we would sit there to 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, and I'm sure Patty would say, where are they? And long rides in the car back and forth to Harrisburg, in which we hashed out what this new system was going to look like in Pennsylvania, and back and forth in committees at the system and with the state level negotiation on a variety of contracts and more arbitrations than any of you can imagine. We were saying at lunch today there was probably no time in that period when we didn't have at least 65 arbitrations laying in our desk waiting to go to in order to accomplish and to fulfill that vision that Foster brought to the university. So for me, there are many fine buildings here now. There are great academic programs. But what Foster's greatest legacy, I believe, will be to this institution is a vision of what it can be, a commitment to that vision by many people both on this campus and around the nation and literally around the world who believe in it, and the will to make all of that happen. Thank you.
Well, a couple of responses to those remarks. First, of all of the things said that required or suggested the requirement of some great commitment and energy, and it gets said so often that it appears to be trite, you can't do any of that, and you can't have any success in it unless you have things in order at home. If you think, and Bob's absolutely right, if you think it's easy to be the spouse of someone like me, some of you may have even reflected on the thought that, God, what must it be like being married to that person. So I want to pay some public tribute, and I didn't even warn her that I was going to do this, to the fact that I've been very fortunate in terms of having Patricia by my side during all of this, and then also having Patricia not only by my side in terms of all that a wife is supposed to be, but also all that she was in addition to that, a wife and a mother and someone who worked and someone who had all those responsibilities of the spouse of the president, all those pressures. She just always dealt with that. And what is probably worth mentioning quickly, although it goes beyond the 17 years that has sort of controlled us, I want you to understand that Patricia was in her 20s when we were married. She's probably very happy to have me say that, because obviously I'm not in my 20s. But Patricia was in her 20s when we were married, and that marriage was characterized by my being an executive officer at Newark State College over in New Jersey during the late 60s and early 70s. And I don't think I had to tell too many people in here, at least those that are over 35 or 40, what was going on in higher education in the 60s and 70s. And I don't think you need much imagination to know what was going on in Newark, New Jersey in the late 60s and 70s. But I spent a lot of time sleeping on the floor in my office there with a walkie-talkie plugged into my ear so that the police could wake me up, because I had a title there the president gave me called, in addition to my title, I was called the contingency planner, which was code for any disgusting thing that came up. And this was the era of occupying offices and riots and so forth. The president left the campus to a comfortable motel room nearby, and I had to be in charge. So my wife could recount anecdotes of a black Muslim who was about 6'8" and weighed about 300 pounds was on a table at a banquet once, inciting to riot, and I joined him on the table and put my hand around his face and held his mouth shut so he couldn't say those words, and my wife almost died. everybody, the police and whatnot, but no one knew. He was a good friend of mine, and I was basically just trying to keep it quiet while I was singing to his ear, "You're going to get in trouble if you keep this up." So it was actually a friendly thing from the Chris. So those were some tough times. And I left those and went to the University of Alaska, where it was worse than here. There's a great myth about the University of Alaska. I learned that when I came here. I mean, some of the people who I think were more interested in detracting used to make fun of the University of Alaska. And, you know, what could you expect from somebody who was the president of the University of Alaska? The president of the University of Alaska, when I was there, meant a 32,000 student campus spread over the largest landmass on the face of the earth in terms of a single university. When I visited one end of that campus and then flew to the other end of the campuses, and some of you won't even understand this because since then they've changed the time zones of the world, but you actually flew through four time zones. I once flew from Attu in the Aleutian Islands to Barrow up on the Arctic Circle and got there before I left. University of Alaska, when I became its president, had a deficit of $25 million. And so I worked for several years in that environment up there, which wasn't the most pleasant thing. And then I came down, and it's been adequately described that there were some serious problems here, too. But I haven't lost sight of the point that I'm trying to make here. That woman over there had to endure all of that for the last 25 years. And it wasn't easy. And we also managed to somehow produce during that time period Jessica, who's now 21 and a student at Grove City. Many of you know her, and we're certainly proud of her, and she's doing well. And then, of course, we still say little Stacy. Yeah. Little Stacy's 14 and is taller than my wife, who's 5'8", and was born on this campus, as Janet said. I can remember my wife accompanying me to events on this campus wearing one of those little backpacks in which Stacy resided for the first 6 or 8 months of her life. And that's also worth mentioning, too. I think no one has happened to mention it here. I also implemented a procedure here that I'm really pretty proud of, and that was, but a lot of others. I remember Bob Weber and others at times have mentioned this to me. Something that Patricia and I decided to do 25 years ago, before we had children. And that was, no matter what we got involved in, we would never exclude the children. Now, I never really knew at that point in time when we made that commitment that I would end up in the line of work where I ended up. But we've held true to that, and we always made the children a part of everything. So that was a big innovation here in terms of events on the campus, where not only banquets and dinner parties and so forth, always our children, whether it was in a high chair or whatever, were a part of it. And also anyone coming to our house was always told, bring your children. And even at the football games now, there are more children in there than there are adults. A couple of quick comments, and then we'll get to that question and answer period I spoke of. First of all, thank you, Patricia, for... Janet quoted the labor intensity here at 87%. I'm trying to make a point here. It's not that I'm a stickler for figures. She's absolutely right. It was, in fact, 87%. Those of you that don't know, what that means is that of your total budget, how much of your budget goes to pay for salaries and fringe benefits? So the labor intensive factor is that percentage. And it was, in fact, 87%. Actually, it was 87.7%. Almost 88, which you didn't mention, and there's some question of this in economic theory, that when you are factoring that labor intensity and you have a deficit, it's appropriate to factor the deficit into the labor intensity because it's money that you don't have. It's committed. In other words, if you have a $2 million deficit, the following year when you get your budget, the first thing you do is deduct $2 million to pay for the $2 million from the previous year. So you do some quick arithmetic, you find out that actually the labor intensity here wasn't limited to almost 88%. It was 100. In other words, there was no budget after paying salaries, fringe benefits, and the deficit. No money, no operational money. Janet mentioned the snow shovels. I don't think she made it clear enough. That's all we had to move snow then. There wasn't even a single snow blower, nor were there enough snow shovels. Now, I'm not going to run you through all of the examples, but I mean, you can kind of project it ahead. If you didn't have shovels, you damn sure didn't have automobiles and equipment and laboratories that were adequately fixed. So it was an interesting time period. A couple of quick comments. I have to tell a fast anecdote, because it was mentioned here, about Reeder Hall and the student union. It had been my experience in New Jersey, and it had been my experience in Alaska, working with governors, that there isn't a governor of a state that won't at some point in time, if you're in their company for any period of time, and particularly back then, and this was Governor Thornburgh, who, under the laws of the Commonwealth then, hired me, they will always say to you when they're in your company, is there anything I can do for you? And the smart in the trade always plan for that. So back in late 80, 81, we had something on the campus which I was advised not to have because it cost us money, people thought. As it turned out, the city of Erie pretty much paid for it. But we hosted Expo 81, which brought some, I don't know, 30, 40,000 people to the campus over a 2-3 day period, and the governor was going to be here and a lot of other things. And anyway, in preparation for that governor, who had only been in office, I guess, 2 years. Yeah. I figured I'll get it. So I had this plan, it was about an inch thick, the diagrams, everything, for the complete renovation and of this facility, as well as the old union. But as Roy reported, not all of it, because that's always a good political move, to only ask for a portion of what you need, and then point out that you're going to get the rest somewhere else. So the governor came, and he was over the house, and I just never could get him alone to talk to him about this. I mean, you know, you have all of the media and the questioning and security people, and then we came on the campus, and we went from place to place, and all day I walked around with this bulging package in my coat, waiting for the opportunity to give it to him, and he never really did what he was supposed to do, which up to that point, which was to say, is there anything I can do for you? So at the very last moment, literally, Patricia and I were escorting Ginny Thornburgh and the governor over to the helicopter that was going to take off over there from near Macomb Fieldhouse. The great prop began to move slowly as Patricia helping Ginny Thornburgh to the helicopter, and I had the governor in my arm helping him to the helicopter, and he turned to me and he said, Foster, you're doing a good job. You're really trying to solve these problems that's up here. If there's ever anything I can do for you, don't hesitate to ask. And I said, with the increased propeller and the wind, dust was coming up and coats were, and I took out this big package and I said, if you get some time, Governor, read this. So it worked. 2 weeks later, Secretary Wolverine, the just past president of Indiana University, called up and said, you know, we've been reevaluating, that's what they would say when that happened, reevaluating the budget thing here. And make a long story short, the governor gave us about $1 million to create what you're in today. This building was boarded up, covered with plywood, and ready to be destroyed, as was the old union, because they were falling apart at the seams. I thought that was an interesting anecdote. A couple of other quick comments. I loved my dear friend Bob Brothers. I loved his quote, consistently believing in his mission. If you know Bob Brothers well, that's Carruthers. He's a poet. He's a published poet. He really is. That's Carruthers, for he's the most stubborn guy I've ever met. Consistently believing in his mission. Thanks, Bob. Could have been said a lot of other ways. One comment, and then we'll open it up for questions. This seems as an appropriate time as any and an interesting audience as I look around to mention to you that some of the things that Janet said, some of the things that Roy said, Cliff said, Bob said, all of which tended to relate, Bob made the specific point, that we tended to speak to the 79, 80, 81, 82 period, and Bob correctly characterized it as a crucible of sorts. Well, I mean, there was the 83, 84, 85, and, you know, on up to the 96 period, too. But that earlier period was tough. And I can't even begin to transmit to you the sorts of thoughts that I have, and they're absolutely thoughts of pleasure and delight, that Frank Pogue and his wife Dorothy Pogue, the new president, are coming to a campus, and they are, and please take my word for this, they are about as charming and pleasant and fully qualified a couple to lead this institution into the 21st century as you could possibly find. Frank Pogue is a deliberative person on the one hand, he's decisive on the other, he's witty, he's charming, he's personable, he's just a host of positive things. And he can come to this campus, and even though we're going to face some hard times in the future, because all of higher education is going to face some hard times, this institution now is positioned in terms of the 14 institutions in the system, and many, many, many that I'm familiar with around this country of ours. This institution is positioned to move forward. And I think under Frank Pogue's leadership, it will move forward. Sure, there'll be some rough water, but it will move forward. So I call upon you. I had no reason to suspect that this would not be the case, but I call upon you to be supportive and help this person. It's an extremely difficult thing to assume a presidency and have to be working 8, 10, 12 hours a day and traveling a lot and all of the pressures, but also to try to learn what it is, what's the nature and the character of this institution while you do this. So his work and the work of his wife, Dorothy, will be cut out for them. But the most pleasant thing is, and Janet just hinted around it a little bit,